Accession number 10403, reel 5.
Mr. Harold Sell, Reel 5. You've described to me the central staff of the brigade. I wonder if you could run through the liaison officers from the various units attached to that staff and what their functions were.
Well, in the first instance, each unit, infantry unit, will send a liaison officer to brigade headquarters for the purposes of keeping an intelligent message carrying or information from commander to commander. In addition, there are the attached specialist officers. For example, there is the gunner officer who will advise the brigade commander on all his gunnery questions. There will be the officers from the supply services, including the troop carrying. There will be the officer and there will be the officer and his team from the Royal Corps of Signals, who will be responsible for all the messages passing from brigade back to division. There will also be, if it is required, any officers that come from arms that are supporting the brigade in any particular operation. For example, if the Air Force were sending a support, they would have an air tentacle unit attached to the brigade headquarters so that they could control the air arm. So that although the brigade headquarters staff is very small indeed, it is possible to expand it to the size that it is required for any particular operation.
Now, the second part I'd like you to go through with me is the formation and working methods of the R and O groups as you saw them at brigade and how they liaised down. If you could explain that for me on the tape.
Well, in the first place, the reconnaissance group is the group which goes out and gets all the information it can, visual information, of the situation that's in front of it and from which the commanding officer will plan an attack or a defence.
Who will it consist of?
Now, it will consist of the brigade commander and a representative from all the units that are taking place in the operation. For example, there'll be a representative from each infantry battalion that is with him. There'll be a gunner representative. And if there was a sapper operation required, there, of course, would be an RE operation. And this group would be given an RV point by map reference.
That's rendezvous.
Yes. On arrival at the rendezvous, depending on the situation, they will singularly or in a group make a survey, a reconnaissance of the position in front of them. And thereafter, they will reform and pull their information or give advice to the commander.
That would be further back.
You're further back. The commanding officer, that is the brigade commander, would hold a planning conference at which all people involved will give their opinions or what they consider might be relevant. Thereafter, the brigade commander makes his own decision and issues the orders of what will take place direct to an O group or order group. And that can be done, if there is time, in writing, or as is usual, verbally. At that O group will be the commanding officers of the subunits, all those who are entitled to be there in order that the orders may be carried out. And they will also ask the commanding officer any questions for which they may have a doubt should it not appear in his orders. Does that explain the difference between the two groups?
It does. So at the reconnaissance, after the reconnaissance and they have the planning conference,
yes,
people are allowed to challenge the ideas of the commanding officer, or at least to put up alternative viewpoints. But at the O group, that is where the orders are given, and the only sort of questions that can be asked are ramifications of detail of things that aren't clear. Would that be accurate?
That would be at the end of every O group. That would be sacrosanct, except the commander will say any questions. And that question is to clarify any detail of the plan he's already detailed.
But not
it is not to alter it. That clear?
That's very clear, yes, thank you. Now, another thing that you have mentioned in earlier conversation is that there was a personal responsibility to check, by the staff, to check that anything that Brigade was responsible for was in fact taking place. Could you describe what you meant by that? You used an example of timetables.
Well, when an order is issued from Brigade Headquarters, you'll appreciate that the instructions are issued to various branches, whether it is supply of petrol, whether it is supply of ammunition, whether it is evacuation of casualties, or whatever it may be. Those are issued, and the various supply points are given as map references. Now, obviously, having given those orders, it is the duty of the brigade staff to decide which ones are the most essential and must not in any way go wrong, and go down and physically check at that particular point that the events are taking place. You give your instructions. You make certain that everything that could possibly be done to give the correct information is made. But then, as a duty, you must go down and see, in fact, it has taken place. Is that clear?
Yes. And if anything had gone wrong, you'd be on the spot.
You'd be on the spot to change the plan or to act as in the best interest. Whereas if you weren't there, the subordinate commander would have no authority to deviate.
Now, the brigade, of course, although a large, or you know, an important part of the army, wasn't actually the top. How did the brigade relate to divisional?
Well, you can have two or more brigades in a division. You can have a two-brigade division or a three-brigade division, or more if you wanted to. It's flexible. And the divisional staff act in the same way to the number of units, to brigades, as the brigades act to the numbers of battalions. It formulates its plan. Commander has made its own reconnaissance with the brigade commander. Before the brigade commander has got his subordinate commanders, he'll have made that. He'll have gone through all the planning conference with his G1 and various other officers. They will have got out the instructions. He will then deliver the plan, either in memo form or by personal instruction, to each brigade commander. And so you can go back to Corps, and then from Corps you can go to Army. But the important thing to remember is that every stage you go back, it is the time lag and the time factor that takes place between that decision being made and the instructions being given and the man in the field being able to react. And it is one of the skills of command that you can virtually forecast or react the time that the man in the front line knows when to start and whether that will fit in with what you think you want, and so coordinate the lot. That's one of the skills.
How, Were there any times when, for instance, brigade commander, was there a theoretical position where a brigade commander could be told to do something by a divisional or corps commander, you know, coming down the line, that was no longer appropriate due to the time lag? I'm thinking of the sort of theoretical position that later on developed when the German attacked and things happened very quickly indeed.
Yeah.
Well, at what point would orders be from above be ignored?
At any time, any commander can change the orders that are given to him, provided he can justify by events that was necessary. For example, if they said, you will attack a certain thing at such and such a time, and you got the order 5 minutes after the attack should be taking place, you're quite entitled to turn around and say, right, it's 35 minutes later. Why? Because I didn't get this order until such and such a time. It is flexible. With that one thing, you must be able to stand up to a court of inquiry and explain why you altered it.
So it's on the personal responsibility.
Responsibility of the man on the ground.
Turning back to the chronological sequence of events, in January 1940, 151 Brigade moved to France as part of the 50th Division. What was your role in that? You must have had a large role as Brigade Transport Officer. Could you tell me how you went about organising your part in it?
Well, in the first place, of course, the warning orders had gone out to all the transport people in the various units and subunits. That warning order consisted of what the operation was likely to be, and there would be an estimated time of movement, and also no movement before a certain time. And that gives a deadline to everybody by which they must be ready, sitting in their vehicles or anything, but no movement before, and that gives them time. Of course, each unit would see that all their vehicles were properly packed, everything in the right order, in accordance with the packing drill.
What was a packing drill?
Well, the packing drill was every man's equipment, everything that you have, ammunition, food, water and everything, has a certain place on the vehicle. And you practice packing and unpacking your vehicles many times to make certain that you can get anything in fast under all circumstances. So that is all done, and they make certain that that is done. On the actual move there, then the operation order was issued. And the operation order would be issued stating the brigade's starting point, because everybody has to move down the route in a special order, in a certain order, and they must move at so many vehicles to the mile, and they move at so many miles in the hour. And as units are fed in from various villages, they must hit this starting point or at various intersections at correct timings. Otherwise, they do not fit into the dog's tail in correct order.
How did you go about it?
So that, of course, is you work out march tables by which you get the map and you give each unit passing point. And then you tell them the time by which the head of their column must pass that point at such and such a time, and the rear of the column must be clear at such and such a time. And the dispatch riders and military police monitor like traffic policemen to see that is done, so that they all fit into a column.
Did you have to have a lot of mathematical expertise to work out the finer details of that, or would some... Did you do it yourself, or at some clerks, or...
Oh, no, you did it yourself. What you knew... how many vehicles at so many miles per hour, or so many vehicles to the mile, covered per mile. You knew the size of the column of each subunit because of the vehicle, so you had a time and space problem. So it passes a certain thing, a certain space passes a point at a certain time. So it was a calculation.
And
you did it yourself.
It wasn't a difficult one once you knew the principles.
Oh, no, it wasn't difficult.
So what other responsibilities would you have? You got them marching, you got them packed, got them off marching.
You got the military police reported from time to time exactly where the heads of the columns and things are. And then you had to rush ahead, having previously found a place on the map, where when you reached the other end, before going into the docks, you didn't want to arrive in one great column, so you had a dispersal point. So the arrival at the dispersal point, you'd given everybody a map reference, so that when they got the dispersal point, they were turned off into the various villages or wherever it was, and lagered up somewhere like that. So that you had them, without stopping the column in any way, they lagered up in various places, all like a snake. And then, of course, the reverse procedure took place. They called them forward as and when you wanted them to go on board.
Was there any problem in this particular occasion when you did that?
No, it wasn't a problem. It was awkward because everything was done in blackout and everything, and all travelling was by night.
Could you just run? I mean, some of the problems are obvious, but could you run through the main problems as you were aware of them?
Well, I think the main problem was that as they were going to a lagering up area, without having been there before, and if a man was leading the column, and a CMP was at the dispersal point, if he didn't go off at the right angle, and it was a blackout, and it's not always difficult to pick up a country lane in the middle of the night with a long column behind you, he might get the whole column bogged down in a side road. These are just practical points which training overcomes, because then you see what you would do before you moved. You would send a motorcyclist off to recce the route for you. But these are just practical problems.
Had you foreseen these problems of the blackout before you started?
Oh, it was part of our drill, yes. Yes, it was part of the drill.
So you'd practiced blackout?
Practiced this, yes.
Two other points before we get on board. Perhaps I should have referred to... Did people get embarkation leave before they left?
Oh, yes, they got embarkation leave.
Did you
they got... No, I didn't have any. It was a period of most incredible activity. Incredible activity. So that was that. But all the troops got embarkation leave. A lot of the officers didn't get embarkation leave because their duties wouldn't allow them to.
And the other thing, you refer to it in part with the blackout. It's almost the idea. Had you had any older officers coming in to tell you about dugouts, to tell you or lecture you about the realities of war and to warn you about things like this? I think you mentioned earlier to me...
Yes, we did have... We had a Colonel Isaacs who was sent to us, who was an officer from World War One, and he had served throughout the war, not only as a regimental officer, but a staff officer. And he spent several weeks giving valuable advice, going around all the units, talking to the men in their billets at night, spending endless hours telling them of the practical things of soldiering, such as all their weapons were new, they had to spend hours loading and unloading and get all the firing pins slide and easy. They had to get their teeth seen too, because there's nothing worse than lying in a ditch with aching teeth. And he went through all the matters of personal hygiene and how to make certain they knew how to darn their socks. In fact, it was a Boy Scout exercise, which is the life of soldiering.
So you were there, you had the brigade in lagers around the port. Which port were you going to?
Well, we were going from Southampton. We didn't go straight onto the dock.
What was
we were lined up all the way along the route back.
And what was the next stage?
Well, the next stage was we went on transport. Our vehicles went on, didn't necessarily accompany the troops on the transport. The transport which went on others. And we went across the Cherbourg and arrived there in the early hours or the middle of the day.
Now, what was your reception in Cherbourg from the local civilians and the French generally? Did you have any impression?
Down was virtually completely deserted. What had happened was the French gendarmerie and the French authorities had, I think, just cleared the port area to give everybody free space so that you could unload your vehicles, you could go to sleep in the back alleys, you could sleep in the trucks, you could do everything. And apart from one or two estaminets which were open and heavily controlled, it was fairly well organised. The French had got it well organised. There was no question of anybody going off the cinema and disappearing to a pub.
So what did you do on landing?
Well, of course,
you must have been.
We had to unpack all our stuff.
Were you responsible at all for the loading and unloading on the ships on the?
No, that was done by the shipping people, by the army shipping side. They loaded everything. But what you had to do on every package, you had to write on its weight in sea tons, so that when the stevedores and people came along, they knew how to handle it. It was all written on in sea tons. Everything was weighed and put on ready to go on board. And, of course, everybody's name was put on a number roll and checked off the number roll as he went up the gangplank. All those administrative things went on.
So you disembarked at Cherbourg.
And we did everything what we had done in reverse. Checked everybody off, checked all the equipment, see that nothing was left behind. And then we were given various villages, names of various villages inland. Each unit was given the name of villages. And we worked on the army principle of advance parties. Every unit had sent an advance party a week beforehand. And they had gone into the villages or wherever they were billeted. They had made the mayor and people acquainted with what was coming and the number of troops and so on, and got the billet, things like that. And then they came back and met the units at the port and guided them back to the billeting area.
And where were the brigade headquarters billeting?
Brigade was billeting in a place called Fresnes-sur-Sarthe. We had a little, it was really a requisitioned cafe, really a requisitioned cafe with a room, and we were all billeted in there. It was in winter, and then we managed to get into various houses, or in the hen houses, wherever we could get.
How did you get on with the French that you were billeted with? What was your impression of them, and what was their impression of you, do you think?
Well, the people that I was with were old people, probably World War One, and of course the French people, as a nation, are used to mobilizations. They're used to national service or conscription, and they're used to people being drafted in and all over the place. And so that when we went there, they didn't accept this as as something which was unique in their lives. Very friendly, always apprehensive of the war, always referred to the Germans as les sales Boches, you know, and very hospitable. And I think we responded. I think one thing that did impress me was the behaviour of the British troops. Because for the first time in their lives, they'd gone to a village they'd never seen in their life. A drink was very, very cheap. Champagne was about a shilling a bottle or something like that. It was very cheap. They had money in their pockets 4 or 5 times more than what the French soldier had. And all these cafes and estaminets there, and apart from a few fellas might get boozed up, I can't recollect any case of what I'd call disorderly conduct. And the inhabitants were very grateful. I saw the mayor before I left, and the first thing he commented on was the behaviour of the British troop.
What were you doing at Fresnes-sur-Sarthe? Just settling down or what?
Settling down, doing a bit of maintaining equipment, getting stuff sorted out, getting all our reinforcements up to date, last-minute medical checks.
So it was a further administrative period.
Period. And then, of course, we got instructions to move up the Belgian frontier. And then, of course, it was a march we had 2 or 3 staging posts, but we went up through France in our vehicles as a motorised unit through France, until we got up the Belgian frontier near Lille.
You arrived near Lille, according to this, at approximately the end of March. So you'd taken quite a while getting through, going up there. Did you do any exercises?
Oh yes, we had arrived at Lille at that time. But of course, we did stay for probably a week or something or other in various places, at which the troops got out and they debussed and they went through various drills in the countryside of bussing and debussing. It was used as training for a tactical march up through France.
Had the change? You said that there'd been peacetime training, and then you'd had the training in England, which had accepted a little bit more risk, but was still highly controlled.
Yes.
Had the training now begun where even more risk was accepted, or was it that still in the future?
That was a little bit in the future, because we were then moving up. Although we were moving up tactically, we were still going through a civilian-friendly country. And again, I stress, great care was put on conduct towards the inhabitants.
A question now, what sort of war did you think you were going to? Did you think it was going to be like the First World War? Did you think it was going to be fire and movement? Did you think, what did you, at the time, did you think it was going to be like?
Well, at the time, of course, the Maginot Line was, impenetrable Maginot Line, went as far as the Belgian frontier. And that we thought that it was only the intransigence of the Belgian government that prevented the French in peacetime extending that Maginot Line right the way to the coast. And that the unfortunate thing was that we had to go in and fill the hole between the Maginot Line and the coast. And that therefore, having to do that, we didn't know where the onslaught would come. And we would then move up. We would have to hastily, as fast as ever we could, construct defences. We could never hope to match the Maginot defences and withstand whatever onslaught the Boche could send.
Had you heard of anything like Blitzkrieg it hadn't started.
No,
then.
No, I hadn't heard anything about it.
Had you even imagined that sort of tactics?
Not at all. The thing that took us by surprise was the use, an accurate use, of their reconnaissance aircraft, followed by dive bombers, the Stuka. That was the thing. And then, of course, followed up later by parachutes. And that was their standard practice, and they'd obviously rehearsed it for a long, long time.
So what sort of assault did you think you would receive? I mean, you didn't expect the Blitzkrieg-style assault. What did you think the Germans would do if and when they attacked through...
Well, Belgium. As far as I was thinking, and of course I'd better reflect what was the general thought, that the BEF as such would have to stabilise the gap between the Maginot and the coast.
You thought there'd be attack by an army similar to your own, or an army using tactics similar to your own?
We thought there would be an overwhelming onslaught against somewhere. And we, as a motorised division, in all our training, would be lying back a bit and whizzed into the area wherever that was most needed or wherever there was a breakthrough, and we'd have to stabilise it. And that was what we were training for all the time, was this rapid movement across France from one place to another and ready to plug a gap or to exploit a success. But that was it.
Now, you got to Lille. What were you doing there? Or the Lille area.
In the Lille area, the battalions were digging in to construct this defensive line.
What principles were they using in defence? What sort of defences were they preparing?
Well, of course, all defence is prepared in what you call defence in depth. That is, you have the forward screens, which can be patrols, it can be anything, which will give you an indication of what is coming on. There is the... what the French used to call the ligne de contact, which was the line upon which you made contact. And then there was what they called the ligne de réserve, the ligne de défense, and the ligne de réserve, so that the idea was that you had this line of contact, you had a stop line, and then you had your reserves to plug in wherever you needed them. That was the basic conception.
And what sort of actual physical, that's the theory of
yes.
the defences, I understand that. What was the physical nature of these lines?
Well, the same thing, that the main defence line was envisaged to be, as I say, to extend the Maginot Line. And in fact, for this purpose, some of our 2nd Line battalions, including the Tyneside Scottish, were sent out virtually without weapons, solely as pioneers, to dig this line.
What pattern of defences was it? Continuous trenches or...?
No, defended localities. You see, wherever you go along, you find ground, certain types of ground dominate other types of ground.